Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Phenotip Speaker Series. We are very excited that it is Rare Disease Month. And so, of course, we're going to be talking about rare diseases because that is a big push for us at Phenotips. And we really want to be able to celebrate February as Rare Disease Month. And we actually have Rare Disease Day this year, specifically because it's the rarest day of the year. So, February 29th. So, every 4 years, it's really cool that we get to have that. But yeah, for people just kind of trickling in, this is the 26th installment of the Phenotip Speaker Series. So can't believe we've been doing it almost 4 years now. I'm your host, Kira Deneen. I am a genetic counselor and very excited to be having this conversation. As I said, we're going to be talking about rare diseases and specifically equitable access to rare disease care. That's going to be the focus of our conversation today. So we really appreciate you joining us. We have a lovely guest that I'm very excited to talk to, Dr. Claudia Gonzaga Carrigui. So very excited to be able to have this conversation. For those that maybe haven't participated in our live webinars before, usually we have myself and the guest, Dr. Gonzaga Carrigui, and I talk about different questions and just, you know, go through all of her expertise about, you know, equitable access to rare disease care. But I really want to get to your questions. I think that's very important. So please, throughout the webinar, please include your questions in the Q&A chat box there. You can submit your questions, and then towards the end of the webinar, we will get to those. But please don't be like, oh, I'll just put it in at the end. Put it in as you're thinking about it, because probably something that we talk about is going to spark your curiosity. So please put your questions at the Q&A box. And a little bit about Phenotips before we get started. Phenotips is a complete solution for medical genetics. Software and services that reflect the diversity of modern families and ease genetic professionals' workflow. And as a genetic counselor, I very much appreciate that. Phenotips genomic health record includes tools like inclusive pedigree builders, human phenotype ontology capture, and diagnostic insights, and really so much more. I think a lot of us in healthcare have experienced that electronic health records aren't built for genetics. So Phenotips really fills in this gap with their genomic health records and provides a unified and seamless genetic workflow. And as I was kind of mentioning, this is a very big focus, rare diseases at Phenotips. Originally, Phenotips was founded to advance rare disease diagnosis, and the Phenotips team has been working closely with the rare disease community over the years, supporting projects across the globe, such as the Undiagnosed Disease Network, UDN, Care for Rare, and Genomic Answers for Kids. And so we're really thrilled to be hosting this Rare Disease Day Month episode. So as I mentioned, my name is Kira Deneen. I am the host for this webinar. I'm also the host for DNA Today. We are an award-winning genetics podcast. We've produced over 275 episodes over the last 11 years. And genetic conversations are very much like the one that I'm going to be having today here. And as I mentioned, I'm also a practicing genetic counselor. But enough about me. What our focus today is going to be about our guest and just capturing all of her insight. So Dr. Claudia Gonzaga Carrigui is a leading researcher in human genetics and genomics. She is a principal investigator of the Mendelian Genomics and Precision Health Laboratory at the International Laboratory for Human Genome Research in Mexico. So her groundbreaking work focuses on identifying disease genes and molecular diagnoses, and her career has really been dedicated to understanding rare disease disorders, and it's paved the way for improving treatments and precision genomic medicine. So thank you so much, Dr. Gonzaga Carrigui, for coming on the show. I'm very excited to be picking your brain. I have so many questions for you just about access to rare disease care. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Kira, and thank you to everyone that's joining today's webinar. It's a pleasure, and I'm very happy to be part of this Phenotips Speaker Series.
Yes, and I know you've watched and listened to other Phenotips Speaker Series, so I really appreciate, you know, you being an audience member and now, you know, being a guest on our show. I would love to get a little bit of background before we dive into all of your expertise on what initially drew you to the field of genomics and rare disease conditions and disorders. You know, what kind of intrigued you? What made you want to help people in our community?
I think my first approach to genetics was probably in middle school when I did my first Punnett square. And yes. I really loved it because to me, I see genetics, or I've said this before, genetics is like the mathematics of biology. And I really like that part of the logic, right? Sometimes, I mean, and it's more complicated than that, but to me, that was kind of what sparked the interest. And then when I was in high school, it was the time of the Human Genome Project. And I think that also had a lot of influence in me in sort of all the talk and the excitement around sequencing the human genome and understanding all the sequence for the human species, right? So, then I did my undergrad in genomic sciences in Mexico and went to do a PhD at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And Baylor has one of the best genetics departments. And it's very focused also on genetic disorders and genomics and that. So when I was a first year graduate student there, that was when we started a project. At that time, it was a pilot because we didn't know if it would work out. But it was at the time where we didn't know if all the expense that had been invested in the Human Genome Project was actually going to be applicable to help patients to improve health. So we did this project on sequencing the whole genome of a person with a genetic disease where we didn't know the molecular cause to see if we could actually find it. Because at that time, like we had seen that the human genome had so many variants, right? Like 3 million variants. And like whether it was even possible to make sense of all that information to identify the one or two variants that were causing a particular disease. So we did that, and that was one of the first proof of concept studies on the application of genomic sequencing for studying genetic diseases. And the laboratory I was a graduate student in was Dr. Jim Dlopskis, which is also one of the major geneticists and contributors to human genetics, especially on genomic disorders and that. So all of that, right, all of those experiences kind of came together to really consolidate my interest in rare diseases, in trying to find what was the cause of genetic diseases. And also it was a time when many of the more common rare diseases had already been studied and that, but we had a lot of genetic diseases that hadn't been very well identified, and especially all of the sporadic conditions that occurred due to de novo mutations had escaped some of the conventional genetic analysis like linkage and that. So with the advent of genomic sequencing, that really opened up all of that application and studying of rare diseases and finding new genes and all of that. So that's kind of where I come from.
Yeah, definitely. And now that it's been over 20 years since I think last year was 20 years, right? That it was 2003. So now it's been 21 years since we finished the Human Genome Project. And I don't know, are you surprised where we are today in terms of how far we've come in diagnosing a lot of rare diseases and finding, like, as you said, especially for de novo, so random changes where we can't say, well, let's look at the parents and see, can we find the variant that, you know, maybe it's autosomal recessive where each parent contributed a variant that led to the rare disease. But, you know, you're mentioning like sometimes it's random and we don't see that there is an aspect that's passed down. What do you think? Like if back in 2003, did you think in 2024 we would be at the point today of diagnosing as many conditions as we have been able to? Did you think there's going to be less, more? I know it's kind of an abstract question, but just for someone that kind of grew up with the Human Genome Project finishing and just being in school at that time.
Sure. I started my undergraduate in 2003. So it was, again, very much in the context of all this excitement and that. And I think there was a lot of hope and a lot of promise. But at that time, I mean, the beginnings, right, of some of the next generation sequencing technologies were just starting. So I don't think anyone really expected, or unless maybe like the people that were actually working on the chemistry
for right.
the technologies, but I don't think that anyone expected that 20 years down the road, we would be sequencing so many patients, so many samples and participants and large cohorts around the world. So I think or the field, right, at that time when the Human Genome Project ended, had the hope that this big endeavor would help to figure out diseases and improve treatments and care. But I don't think there was an idea of what the next decade, right, even in the development of next generation sequencing technologies, and then thereafter in the implementation and large scale projects that we are seeing now, I don't think anyone was expecting it. I think currently the major challenge is that, yes, we can do this. Like, we have the technologies, we have not just like short read sequencing, we have long read sequencing, we have all these wonderful technologies that we can use to find the causes of diseases. I think the problem is the implementation, the equitable implementation around the world, because the truth is that not every patient with a genetic disease has access to this. It varies a lot depending on where you're born and what your economic status is, and that setup, right? And I think that's where we need to take more responsibility as a genomics community in making these technologies more available.
Yeah, I think that's been a big part of, and I talked to Dr. Eric Green in some shows that I've done, who is pretty instrumental in the Human Genome Project, and he's part of the NIH. And I think a big part that he has focused on of, you know, looking back at the last 20 years is that the cost of sequencing has dropped so much. So it is improving access to care because people can afford it much more than if you said 20 years ago, oh, rare disease patients or undiagnosed patients, right? That's probably the better term there, would be able to have their genome sequenced and have that information. It would almost be, you know, standard routine. I think that would have blown people's minds back in 2003, that in 20 years-ish, we would be at that point where it's not, you know, crazy to be ordering that it's like, okay, yep, that's, you know, pretty standard in terms of the UK, Canada, the US. You also have experience in Mexico, and that's where you're, you know, currently working. I want to learn a little bit more about that in terms of in other countries. I mean, you're pretty well-traveled. So in terms of your experience, how does that access look like for people in other countries, including Mexico? Is it similar in terms of if you have an undiagnosed disease? Yeah, I was kind of thinking, unfortunately, it's not. Could you speak a little bit more to that?
Sure. Yeah, no, access is terrible. So I tend to tell people that, and then it's not just Mexico, right? It's Latin America as a region, and also a lot of other low and middle income countries, Southeast Asia, they are in the same boat. And I tend to tell people that in Mexico, we're about 10 years away behind from what like the US, the UK, Europe are right now. I mean, I do feel very much as when we started the Centers for Mendelian Genomics at Baylor back in 2011, so we're like, yeah, there was some interest and some adoption for some of these technologies, but there was still a lot of skepticism. And one of the major issues that we have in Mexico and Latin America and other LMICs is the cost. Because for us, since, I mean, all of the major sequencing companies are in the US, the UK, they have representation in Europe, some are in China and Korea and that. But in the majority of what is commonly known as the Global South, right? They are starting to have representation, but it's mostly commercial, and they usually go through intermediates to commercialize the products. Everything is imported. So we have import taxes. We have, they are heavily taxed because they are not basic goods, right? So all of that keeps increasing the price. So for us, it is about 3 to 5 times more expensive to sequence an exome, let's not talk about a genome, an exome in Mexico and in Latin America than it would be in the US. So what a lot of the clinicians do is if the family can pay it, because also none of this is covered by insurance or
the I was going to ask, like, the insurance piece, how does that work? Do a lot of people have insurance? Is that, you know, private insurance, government insurance? How does that work in Mexico? I don't personally know too much about the healthcare system there.
Yeah, so a lot of the, well, in Mexico, we have a mostly socialized healthcare system, and a lot of the Latin American countries do have the same kind of system. So, for example, and the Mexican healthcare system is very complicated because depending on who you work for, you have different affiliations for social systems. So we have the Institute for Social Security, the Institute for Social Security for Workers of the State. We have the social security system for people that don't have a work affiliation. So it's very fragmented. And none of those, since they are all public systems, so none of those cover these type of technologies and analysis for genetic studies. And then very few people have private insurance. It is expensive. So also most of the people that would have it would have a higher socioeconomic status. So that's also a major differentiator. But even then, the people that have insurance don't, the insurance companies here are not really aware of these technologies, which again, it's very similar to 12 years ago when we were starting this in the US. So again, like most of the people that that have these studies in Mexico would pay it out of pocket, which is very expensive. So also there is a bias there to the people, the families that can pay this. And if they can pay this, the samples are sent out to the US, to clinical labs in the US or to Germany or to Korea. So that also causes a huge problem because all of that information, I mean, most clinicians will get the clinical report and give the result positive or a BUS or negative to the patient, but they don't request the data back. So then all of that data stays in the servers of the companies that sequence them elsewhere, right? That data doesn't come back to Mexico. And that would be extremely useful to build like databases and frequencies for variants in Mexican population, but we don't have that. So we are having also that drain of genomic data, right? And genomic information that would be extremely useful for the population, but because of, again, the lack of access and the extremely high cost of these technologies to do them in the country, we are sending samples generally out of the country.
And that must increase turnaround time too, because if you're sending it to other countries, just that shipping time, I mean, the cost there, I understand kind of more now that you're saying it's about 10 years behind other countries. And, you know, you're kind of mentioning Mexico along with other places like Latin America, that looking at some of these issues, I mean, how do we start dismantling these? How do we start attacking them so that people, we can, as we're talking about today, equitable access to rare disease care? I mean, how can we improve this in terms of lowering the costs or having some of these, you know, the private insurance? Yes, but it sounds like people that have private insurance have a higher socioeconomic background. So in terms of equitable access to care, it seems like being able to have government insurance be able to cover this, certainly in terms of, as we're talking about, kind of like undiagnosed diseases that probably are rare. Are there things that, you know, if you could have, you know, access to people that are making these policies or laws that you'd say, oh, I wish we could do this or that, or, you know, start educating here? I mean, this is a big question. We're certainly not going to resolve it right in the next 40 minutes, but what are some of your mindset in terms of just how we can start improving this?
Yeah, so I do strongly believe that we need to show that it works, that it's doable in the countries, in these economies, in the healthcare system. Because again, I I keep saying this phrase that once one of the legislators told us, because I think it just represents very much what the feeling is from health authorities and legislators in Mexico, and again, other Latin American countries, right? They say like, this is like a space science. So again, to them, this is something that is foreign, that it's happening in the US, in the UK, it might as well be happening in Mars, but it's not something that can be done in Mexico. And so what I've come to think in terms of this is that we really need to demonstrate the cost effectiveness, the applicability, and the efficiency of doing these studies here. So as part of that, right, again, if we travel back as to where we were 11 years, 12 years ago in the US, so we started in 2020, the Mexican Network for Rare Diseases, which is basically an initiative to bring together clinicians and research and patient organizations to enable molecular access, to molecular diagnostics. So again, right, in that same context of like doing it in the research space first to demonstrate the utility, and then with that data, go to authorities, to health authorities, to legislators, and show like this works. This is how much you save. This is how much you save in years, right, of a cost of living with a diagnostic odyssey, going from different specialists to different specialists and having all these exams and that, whether you do one test, right? We're doing exome sequencing in the project. So if you do exome sequencing and then finding an accurate diagnosis. So we're taking that approach, again, in some ways, having experienced that before, that's kind of the route I'm taking, sort of demonstrating it first in the research space, and then using that data to really advocate for interest and access. And then we have been advocating directly with legislators. So actually next week, on the 28th, we have a legislative forum in the chamber of what it's called here, the Cámara de Diputados. So it would be like the Senate in the US, precisely to talk about the need for early diagnosis and accurate diagnosis for patients living with rare diseases in the context of Rare Disease Day. And we are sort of repeating that message, and we're trying to make that message clear. What are the needs? Because I think so we also need government, right, to get interested and invest in these technologies, in building this infrastructure, these labs, and that. For example, help us with lowering taxes, right, or lowering import fees. I think that would be extremely useful to start lowering the costs, but at the same time, we are sort of talking and working with some of the sequencing companies to help us out do some of these research projects and pilot projects in Mexico and Latin America to demonstrate that efficacy and cost effectiveness, so that we can come with the evidence to show government that this can work, and then they can help us lower the cost so that we can have a better market, right, for these sequencing technologies and demand, because that's the other big issue. If everything is sent out abroad, then there's no demand internally. And then if you have a diagnostic lab that has a higher cost within the country with no demand, then that lab won't work. And so it's a multi-faceted problem, but we're trying to tackle it through research, through advocacy, education, also educating clinicians about these technologies, when you can use them, what are the limitations, how to partner with some research projects or other institutes that are doing this. So we're trying to work on that.
And oftentimes when we're talking to legislators, I've done a little bit of that in the US, that when you come at it from a fiscal perspective and you say, hey, this is how much the government will save, and you kind of mentioned this, I'm pulling it out so that people really, you know, I make sure that they get this gem of information you shared, that when governments are spending so much money on treatment for an undiagnosed condition, like that really adds up. And when we look at, in general, the drop of cost of sequencing for, as we were talking about, more focus on exomes, that the government will actually save money with that. And that's a big key, I think, to getting legislators on your side and everything, because like, oh, we're going to save money by doing this, because a lot of different initiatives and things, people are asking for money and saying, hey, we need money for this. But you're saying, ah, it's actually the opposite. The government can save money if we are covering at least some of the cost of exome. And a part I didn't really think about too much until you brought it up was, if you're sending all these samples out to other countries, then Mexico is not having their own database, and other Latin American countries not having their own database, especially for people of Mexican ancestry, to say, hey, these are the variants that we're seeing in our population, and being able to curate those variants and have a big database, that is such a loss. And that makes sense, that kind of, because you're sending out so many samples to be tested, you're not getting all that data and building that up. And, you know, I think there's been a big shift, I would say, in the last 5-10 years, of a lot of companies being better about data sharing and saying, this is really where we need to be doing this in order to move genomics forward just globally. But that's a huge aspect too. And just having the government kind of work with you guys of saying, okay, you know, can we lower the tax costs of, like, you know, from other countries, but also, like, can we just kind of start infrastructure in Mexico and other countries that are facing some of the same issues? And, you know, kind of on the flip side, we're talking about the government, we're talking about healthcare providers all being aware, but also just the public. I think that's really important in terms of the public understanding access and where they should be going, right, for care, and to be on that diagnostic odyssey and hoping to get an answer. What are different ways that you think that we can better address the public and educating the public in countries like Mexico, where we're not as far advanced as we are in, say, the UK, Canada, the US, and some of the other countries you mentioned? Because I think that's a big part too, because if the public is asking for it, that's a whole nother layer that I think is going to move things along.
Right. Yeah, totally agree. And yeah, we are also, well, through the Mexican Network for Rare Diseases, we do a lot of education. And so on the exact Rare Disease Day on the 29th, we're having a symposium. So it's the International Symposium for Rare Disease Day that we've been doing for the last 4 years. And it's in Spanish, so it's virtual. So it's directed to Mexican and Latin American public, precisely to start sort of raising this awareness, increasing that education about this. And also in 2022, we started the Mexican registry for rare diseases. So there has been a lot of demand from the rare disease community in Mexico to have a national census. And the government started in 2021, in August, the census, and shut it down in October. Because they thought that in the middle of the pandemic, they would look bad if they had sick people, like, registering.
Yeah.
So because of that, we started the registry in 2022. We launched it on Rare Disease Day 2022. And then, so some of the stuff we'll be presenting at the symposium on the 29th is actually the results of the first year. And one of the main things is, there are very interesting findings, but one of the things related to what you were asking is that, about 74% or so of the patients that have registered, one of the questions is whether any of the physicians that they had visited had mentioned to them that their disease could potentially be genetic. And 74% said yes. Yet only 20% were referred to a geneticist. So again, even if there is awareness, right, that some of these conditions are genetic, very few of them get referred to genetics and genetic testing. And that's worrisome, because again, that also talks about the lack of awareness from other specialists and sort of how to better refer these patients and better manage some of these conditions. We've heard some horror stories from some of the families that we have recruited in the research study where they say like, yeah, this physician told me my kid had a genetic disease and basically told me to go home and enjoy my child because it's going to die because it has a genetic disease. And again, like that is not necessarily true for many conditions, especially nowadays. And very few of them are getting tested. So we do try to, we also produce infographs every month in Spanish about different rare diseases to also try to start raising that awareness, right? And then sometimes we hear from people like, oh, maybe I have that, or I know a person that has that. And I think just having them think about these diseases as not so rare, right? I think every one of us knows at least one person that has a genetic condition, if not ourselves. So I think raising that awareness that they are not as rare as we think, right? These are not very rare congenital malformation syndromes, but they, like, if you have kidney disease, you might as well have some genetic susceptibility to that condition. And so I think that is very important. And also, as you say, right, like having the public demand more of these access to technologies and approaches.
So why do you think there's such a big discrepancy then of healthcare providers, you know, in this survey and everything that you're referencing, about 75%, I think you said, are like, yeah, I think it, you know, is genetic, but then only like 25% are actually referring to genetics. So why do you think that is? If people are identifying, yeah, well, I think this is a genetic condition, do you think it's mostly that they're like, well, I don't know where to refer, the wait lists are too long? Why do you think, because that is a huge discrepancy to me. If it's genetic, why are they not following through with, hey, let's follow up with this?
Well, I do think that, so one study that we're doing, one more than a study, a review, is about genetics education in Mexico. Most medical programs, so medicine in Mexico is studied at this undergraduate level, and most medical programs have one semester of genetics, if any, and that's it. And I think, and you can also chime in with your experience, but I think in general, specialists from other specialties in medicine until recently have thought more about genetics as part of their particular specialty, right? Like, I think neurologists have been much more in some ways forced to think about genetics because there are many neurological conditions that if you do an exome, you'll find a gene associated. But for many other specialists, endocrine or cardiovascular, they don't really think about, again, I think there is this perception that genetics are conditions that are congenital, these malformation syndromes, very severe, that you cannot do anything. And there is no this perception like, oh, maybe if I send them to a geneticist, like they can have testing, they can have a molecular diagnosis, and that can help with their condition. So there's this perception that you cannot do anything if it's genetic. And I think there's that disconnect in as part of medical education, right, in terms of how other specialties think about genetics and genetic diseases.
Yeah, I think that's unfortunately somewhat similar in the U.S. for the medical schools that I am, you know, medical students that I've worked with and students that have rotated through the clinic I work at. You know, I'm always asking, like, so how much genetics do you learn? Like, do you know what I do as a genetic counselor? Like, what's your level of understanding there? Like, yeah, we have a little bit of genetics, but it doesn't seem to be as much as it should be. And obviously I'm going to be biased, right? I work in genetics. So obviously I want all genetic or all healthcare providers to understand, like, how does genetics play a role in their specialty, right? But at the same time, it's like, it's one thing if they have, you know, one course dedicated or whatever, but I almost think, and I don't know, I'm not a doctor, but to have it sprinkled in throughout, like when you're learning about neuro conditions, include, oh, you know, if you're looking at Alzheimer's, learn about the APOE gene and the different variants there and what are the risks there, and just be sprinkling it in. I feel like that would be really helpful there. But yeah, I mean, I have so many questions for you. I want to take a moment for people that are watching us live, because we have a couple questions coming into the Q&A, but I want to make sure I get to your your question during the show here. So please throw in the Q&A, because we're going to get to those in just a little bit. But another question I wanted to ask you is, you know, we're in the beginning age of AI, right? I've definitely caught the bug. I use AI in a lot of my workflow for podcasting and different things here. Not as much with patients, because I'm a little worried about HIPAA and things like that, in terms of using, you know, Google's Gemini or OpenAI's ChatGPT. But with AI technology, do you see there being any advantage or ways that we can be utilizing AI to make this access to rare disease care more equitable? Because I think that there's just so much power behind AI, and it's also scary, right? It's exciting and scary, just like genetics, honestly. But yeah, I don't know. Do you think of anything? It's kind of a out of the box question, but I'm curious if there's anything that comes to mind in terms of how we can improve access to care with newer technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely exciting times, right, in terms of the technologies that we have, what we can do, and then incorporating some of these AI tools and that. So I do think that in the near midterm future, we will have a lot of the variant interpretation probably done by AI. And we already have seen, right, some of the facial recognition software that are used for identifying facial gestalt in patients sort of use AI and have a really good rate for saying like, oh, this might be Coffin Siris syndrome or mm-hmm. any other syndrome, right?
Based on the physical features and computer vision of using that and saying, okay, if I see maybe the eyes are spaced this far apart or the ears are rotated or lower, something like that. Yeah.
But I think, so in the same sense, right, as with genomic technologies, we do need to be careful, because all of these AI tools and technology are as good as the data that we feed them, right? And in the same sense that we have the problem with underrepresentation of populations, of diverse populations in genomics, and we have, I mean, if you have a patient of European ancestry come and get an exome or a genome, right, you have a very high likelihood of having an accurate finding and giving them like, this is a pathogenic variant and that. Versus if you have a Hispanic or an African-American individual, then like you might have a lot of BUSs and we don't know what to do with that. So I think it will be the same. It is the same thing with AI. So if we don't have enough representation of variants from other populations, then the AI won't know what to do with that variant, right? How to interpret it. And we've already seen this for the facial recognition programs, that they are very well trained for European ancestry patients, because that's what most of the literature, what most of the patients and data is available. But if you put in a Hispanic patient, then they don't do as well, right? The performance drops because of the obviously, right, like population specifics, characteristic and variance in terms of the phenotype is broader. So then it doesn't know, right? So I think we need to make an effort also in how we use AI for this, to have data from diverse populations, that it's more representative of different ethnicities and that, so that these AI tools can be as helpful for European ancestry populations as for underrepresented populations.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think there it's so many similarities. I like how you phrase that in terms of genetic testing. We need really good data in terms of lots of variants, right? So we have that representation and we can say, okay, someone that comes from a non-European background to say, okay, yeah, we have enough data to say we can call this pathogenic, benign, somewhere in between. But yeah, whenever the data that we have in these AI language models, that's what it's pulling from. So bad data in, bad data out, just like genetic testing. And I think we've seen that. I think even the last few months with Google's Gemini, I saw in the news this morning of you know, when you ask it for certain things, you know, it's coming up with, you know, images of historical figures that, or like, you know, I think one of the examples was Vikings that are known to, you know, have European ancestry being Vikings, but then creating them to, with these images that they're populating, to have a different ancestry. And so it's like, they're trying, but not in a very effective way. And it's almost like we have to be so careful how we use it. And I think in terms of using it as a tool and not replacing what we do, I think that's a big talk in a lot of people's jobs of, oh, is AI going to replace my job? And that may be applicable in some areas, but I think in genetics, it's, we need to use it as a tool to be able to say, okay, can this help? But we need to be able to be giving it the data, seeing what it comes back with, understanding that more, and just having it kind of speed up the time too, because I think with turnaround times, I would think it's going to improve it, because if you have a human looking through all of this data, I mean, genomic data is a lot to go through, especially when we're talking about exome, genome. I mean, it's so much. So I think having tools to kind of get through that is really helpful, but I am very scared about what is the data set going to be? Because just as we started in genomics, we started with the Human Genome Project was, you know, I think exclusively, correct me if I'm wrong, anybody in the audience, that it was pretty much exclusively European ancestry in terms of the genetics they were looking at. So we're still trying to catch up. So I think that's just such an important piece and goes back to what we talked about in terms of if countries themselves don't have databases, it's going to set them back in terms of being able to use AI, because they're not going to be able to pull from their own data sets, especially if companies aren't really sharing their own data with other countries and other genetic testing companies. So I think that's just so important, but I'm excited to see where we go with it, but also like hesitant, right? I think, you know, it seems like you're in a similar way at this point.
Yeah, and I think that's a healthy place to be, right? Yes. And ultimately, I think, as you say, right, there are, in genetics, yes, the analysis interpretation can be automated quite a bit, but ultimately, and especially in your profession, right, as genetic counseling, there is no substitution for that human interaction where you deliver that result in a manner to the patient, to the family, that it's sympathetic, right, to the situation that they are living, and then they sharing that journey with them on what to do next if they have a second pregnancy, what do they do? So all of that, I don't think will be ever replaced by an AI. And that's something that we many times, right, that softer part of genetics is something that it's many times overseen and sort of not valued as much. But I think it's as relevant, right, as the variant that you are delivering back to the patient.
Yeah, definitely. And we've talked so far a lot about diagnosing and genetic testing and all that side. But, you know, our general topic here today is equitable access to rare disease care. So, you know, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about treatment and that side of care. Precision medicine has been a major focus of treatment in rare disorders and just genetic diseases in general. What are the potential benefits of precision genomic medicine for patients with rare genetic diseases? I mean, are there potential harms we need to be aware of in terms of access when we're starting to talk about precision medicine, also kind of known as personalized medicine, in terms of people, because it's maybe not as much of a standard treatment potentially that a lot of people are getting, and it may be a little bit more niche and personalized to them, right? Are there issues there in terms of like how we can benefit a lot of people with this, like just getting access to a very specific treatment? I imagine can be kind of hard, especially when there's maybe less providers in the genetic space and less healthcare providers that are thinking of that, right? You shared that stat earlier, just where it highlighted the discrepancy between healthcare providers being like, I think this is genetics, and, you know, referring them to a genetic professional that can help. What are your thoughts just kind of on precision medicine and how we can make sure that we're doing all we can so that there is that equitable access to that type of treatment?
I try to be optimistic on that. I think it's also a very exciting time to be in and very hopeful, especially for families and patients living with rare conditions, because we are having all this development of new molecular therapies and genome editing and that even what, like 10 years ago, you couldn't think of like genome editing for sickle cell disease, right? So I think it's a very exciting and hopeful time, but at the same time, and I mean, of course, my work focuses on molecular diagnostics, so I'm sorry to go back to that, but I believe that the beginning of precision care and personalized treatment goes back to an accurate diagnosis, right? And again, this goes back to, if people are not having access to an accurate molecular diagnosis, then you don't know like whether this is a condition because of a gain of function variant or a loss of function or what gene, and whether there is a clinical trial. I mean, we're seeing more and more clinical trials moving to very specialized recruitment, right? Based on specific genetic conditions rather than all diabetes or all cancer, right? Or breast cancer, but it's like BRCA1 mutation specific breast cancer, right? So we are seeing more of that shift towards molecularly driven therapeutics and clinical trials. That again, if patients in Mexico, Latin America, and low and middle income countries do not have access to, that also puts them years away from having access to a treatment. And then, of course, there's the other part of cost, where yes, some of these therapies are being developed, they are being very successful, but then the cost is just so huge for patients. And they will never be able to access that, not because the technology doesn't exist or because there is no treatment for that disease, but just because the cost is prohibitive. So, I mean, one of the examples that I think it's very clear, and to me, I mean, I had seen some of the preliminary data for the spinal muscular atrophy trials and the preclinical in the mouse and that. And that was so exciting, right? Because these are kids that many of them wouldn't live past 2 years of age. Now we are seeing kids that were treated very early and now they are walking and achieving all their milestones. And you couldn't think of that like a few years ago. And now we have patients in Mexico and in other countries where first, like the delay to having a diagnosis for SMA and having a molecular testing is like months, right? When we know if you have to treat some of these kids very early on. And then even if they get the diagnosis, like the cost is so big that they just can't get access. So
it's astronomical. I think you're talking about like Spinraza, right? For SMA. And like, that was groundbreaking and so exciting, right? Like what a moment in our field. But yeah, how can you afford it? I think the last I like, at least when it came out, it was like over $1 million, right? Like, I mean, it's just, how can anybody afford that? Unless you're in that top, you know, 0.1%.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, so I know of, I think 2 or 3 patients in Mexico that have been treated with SMA therapies. And one of them was because the family is just very wealthy, right? And they were able to pay it. But I mean, most patients wouldn't be able to afford that cost of these therapies. And I think, again, just morally and ethically, it's sad and it's heartbreaking that, again, we have the technologies, we have the therapies, for some of these conditions that before they really didn't have an option, but now there is the option. It's just unattainable for them.
Yeah. And that's a big part that I don't want, you know, our field to like not think about and lose sight of, because we celebrate these milestones as we should, right? You know, when this SMA drug, you know, was released, you know, in the last few months, we have an FDA approved, the first one CRISPR-based. And, you know, you kind of mentioned that in passing with sickle cell. This is major in our field, right? I didn't think I would see a CRISPR-based drug that's FDA approved until the end of my career. I'm at the beginning of my career. I'm like, this is so exciting. And I don't want to, you know, damper that at all. But the second part to that is, just because we have it, we're not done. Like, we have to work on having this be accessible for people, having it be affordable, you know, even just physically accessible. Like, where can they go get this drug, right? Do they have to do the, you know, medical tourism, as we say, and go to different countries and have that? I mean, who can afford to do that? There's just so much, you know, parts to it. So it's like, when we have something that's, you know, in the US FDA approved, wow, like, let's, you know, celebrate that, but also we got to continue it, right? We got to make sure that just because it's approved and people can use it doesn't mean that people actually can. So I think that that's a big issue that, you know, I don't see being talked about enough. I certainly see it being talked about, but I'm like, we got to focus on it a little bit more. But I have so many questions, but I want to get to some viewer questions. Mafa, shout out to you. I know you're a podcast listener and you've been attending the Phenotip Speaker Series. Mafa is from Nigeria. And his question for you is, how can international cooperation and solidarity help to achieve equitable access to rare disease care? So, you know, you talked about this a little bit, but any other thoughts just on how we can work, you know, better globally and internationally to be able to achieve this?
Yeah, I think international collaboration is really important, and having these consortia and large projects where there's inclusion of patients from low and middle income countries. I think so this needs to be sort of worked in parallel. On one side, building the capacity locally, it's really important, because I do not think that it's sustainable to just depend from international collaborations and collaborators abroad to get these. I mean, if you really want clinical implementation in the countries, you do need to have that infrastructure, that expertise in the country. But at the same time, right, like, we cannot wait 5 years or more for that infrastructure to be in place. So we do need and are very grateful, right, for international collaborations. I think the important part with international collaborations is that there is a recognition that if there is a partnership with low and middle income countries, and researchers and clinicians in low and middle income countries, is really a partnership, right? That we are not just shipping samples out and then not receiving that information, because again, we go back to this leak of genomic information that, yes, it looks great in an AIH grant to say, like, yeah, we're recruiting patients from South America and for diversity. But then if none of that data goes back to the researchers, to the clinicians, to the patients in the country, then it fails to achieve the purpose. So I think really having equitable collaborations and true partnerships with clinicians and researchers in the countries, because ultimately they are the ones that are going to be returning results to the patients, following up, like thinking about the next step, right? And also pushing the agenda in their own countries for that access. So that there really needs to be that collaboration, rather than just see low and middle income countries as providers of diverse samples, which unfortunately is something that happens for some studies. That would be my take on collaboration.
Yeah, definitely. We have a great follow-up question from Mary Wang from the Rare Disease International. She said, wonderful to hear about networking of centers and expertise in Mexico. What would you suggest to other countries who might be just starting about setting up a national network to improve access to health services? What's an important first step? Because I think you're kind of, you know, talking a little bit further into it in terms of, you know, continuing in Mexico, but maybe for other countries that are further behind?
I think starting to form those partnerships between clinicians and researchers and also patient organizations is really important. So in Mexico, for example, there is still a big gap in sort of clinicians do clinical work, but not many of them are involved in research. And then researchers are doing research, but there's not a lot of clinical implementation. And that's a lot of where the breakdown happens, right? In terms of really establishing these programs and doing actual real life implementation of these technologies. So I think having working on those connections, right? And that, again, that education from healthcare providers of these technologies and how can be done, even if right now it starts in research and not necessarily there are clinical labs doing that. And then also incorporating patient organizations and the patient views is really important. So for, well, I talked a little bit about the Mexican Network for Rare Diseases, but in Latin America, we also started back in 2020, this initiative to bring together patients, patient organizations, clinicians, legislators, investigators, to really advance the agenda as a region, right? And leverage some of those commonalities, like the language, the culture, the similar healthcare systems in Latin America, to share experiences and also to find what can we leverage that maybe it's working in one country that can work in the many other countries as a region. Because one of the issues, right, like, I mean, Mexico, we do have our challenges, but we also have access to certain things. But other countries in Latin America and the Caribbean don't have that, right? So we are really trying to come together with stakeholders in the region to lift the whole region and not just individual countries. So also, I guess in that sense, maybe finding and at the regional level, perhaps which countries might be stronger in certain things and then making some regional alliances, I think that's also helpful because ultimately, I think, especially for countries that don't have a lot of resources, like having a major sequencing center is probably not going to happen. So one of the things we're working with the Latin American initiative is, which is called CEPGAL. So it's exactly to establish regional centers for molecular diagnostics so that the countries around the regional centers send all their samples there and have access to that diagnostics because it, again, I think it's not realistic to expect that every country will have a major sequencing center.
Yeah, I think being realistic about it and leveraging the relationships with other countries and looking at countries that are a little bit further ahead, as you were saying, and using that kind of as a playbook and saying, okay, this is the steps that they took to get to where they are. Can we kind of replicate that in our own country? So Mary, hopefully that answered your question. I think that was wonderful. But thank you so much. I mean, I feel like I've learned so much in this and you are just such a wealth of information. So I really appreciate it, Dr. Gonzaga Carrigui. I think this has just been fantastic. We have people like Eric and Daniel in the chat just saying that this has been so informative and just so helpful. I think that this has just been amazing. And for people that maybe haven't listened to us before, we have all of our episodes. This is episode 26. We have all of our episodes available in podcast players. So you can just search Phenotip Speaker Series and the blue icon, our album art will pop right up. And after we finish this webinar in just a couple minutes, you're going to see a feedback link in your browser when this webinar ends. It's also going to be emailed to you in the next day. And we really appreciate if you can take a moment and offer some feedback and help us improve with our upcoming series installments because we want to cover information that's relevant for you guys and helpful. This email will also include a link to the Phenotip Speaker Series page where you can sign up to receive alerts on upcoming sessions so you can tune in live to us and then be able to ask questions like Mafaz did, Mary, Eric, Daniel, Maria. So I think that this is just really, really helpful. You guys can also head over to phenotips.com, hit the resources tab, and then the speaker series is going to pop up on the drop-down menu if that's helpful for you. So I want everybody to stay tuned for that next webinar. We really appreciate everybody coming in. And if we didn't get to your question, I really hope we can next time. And we can also pass that along to Dr. Gonzaga Carrigui. But thank you so much for being our esteemed guest. I have learned so much from this and just your wealth of information from an international perspective is just really, really, really valuable. And I just really appreciate the hour that you took to be able to educate myself, everybody watching and listening to this live, and also people that are streaming this later. That's a lot of people. So thank you so much. Any last thoughts as we close out?
Well, thank you again for the invitation. It's been a pleasure meeting you and talking to you. And thank you to Finotips for the invitation in the speaker series. And I am really hopeful that genomics will be a force to achieve health equity in the world. And I do hope that as a community, along with the broader society, we fight for that we achieve health equity for everyone everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. And people can check you out all over the place, LinkedIn, Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it these days. Everybody feel free to give Dr. Gonzaga Carrigi a follow and be following up. There you go. Right there is X and Blue Sky handle, as well as me if you're interested. I have a lot of similar conversations on DNA Today. And you can search DNA Today in your podcast player. And while you're there, obviously you got to search Phenotip Speaker Series, because I doubt you've listened to every episode. We've got 26 now. So you got a nice backlog of episodes with just amazing guests, just like Dr. Gonzaga Carrigi. So thank you everybody for tuning in. Hopefully you learned as much as I did today. And everybody, happy Rare Disease Month. I hope everybody has plans as Rare Disease Day is coming up on February 29th. Dr. Gonzaga Carrigi, I know you have quite a few plans next week to celebrate and honor the month and the day. So thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll see you at the next Phenotips webinar. Bye, guys.